This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, the latest on Tibet. We speak to a reporter in Dharamsala, India, the headquarters of the Dalai Lama.
The Tibetans see this as the best opportunity they're going to have in the foreseeable future to influence the outcome of the Tibetan situation.
Plus, can greed help Africa? And reviving the silk industry in Cambodia.
In the pot, silk is soaking in a murky concoction. Morimoto flashes me one of his crazy grins and pulls out a tangle of rusted metal. It's a rifle, he tells me, from Cambodia's civil war. The high-quality metal in guns is one of the best ways to fix a die.
That's coming up on the World Vision Report. China has reacted swiftly to the recent protests in Chinese-controlled Tibet. The Chinese government has jailed protesters, blocked phone lines, and kicked out foreign journalists. The unrest began several weeks ago when a peaceful demonstration by Tibetan monks turned into rioting. The Tibetans want an end to Chinese control over their culture and religion. Some want total independence. The Dalai Lama is the Tibetan spiritual leader. He lives in exile in India in a town called Dharamsala. That town is also home to a large community of Tibetans. Reporter Peter Aronson lives there, and he joins us now. Peter, welcome to the World Vision Report.
Thanks, Peggy.
Can you tell us about how many Tibetans live in Dharamsala, and how are they reacting to all the protests going on in neighboring Tibet?
Well, Dharamsala is a small town with at least 8,000 Tibetans living here, according to their government in exile, which is headquartered here. They're experiencing a complex mixture of emotions. When I talk to people here, the first word they often use when they're speaking to me in private is that they're sad. They're sad about what's happening because they know that their loved ones, friends and family, their fellow Tibetans are suffering under the Chinese. When you see people out on the streets, they're angry. They're angry about the treatment they've been suffering at the hands of the Chinese. And this is a pent-up anger that's been building and building for the past 49 years. They're also hopeful that this uprising will lead to something. And they're desperate to keep world attention focused on this issue. So it's quite a mixture.
So these Tibetans who live in your town are identifying with their family and friends back in Tibet, and they're actually conducting protests of their own where you are, aren't they? Can you describe that, what you're seeing on the ground there?
Sure. Well, first of all, they're protesting peacefully here. They're marching, they're holding candlelight vigils, prayer vigils, what they're calling hunger strikes, although those are really actually sort of fasts. People group together for 24 hours at a time to fast in public. All of these things are aimed at bringing attention to what's going on in Tibet.
So what is it the protesters are actually saying?
Well, if you listen to what they're saying on the streets, they're saying stop the torture and killing in Tibet. They also want freedom of religion. Now, that's a big key because they're Buddhists. They don't feel that they have a free exercise of their religion, and they want freedom of the press, including the return of foreign journalists to the area to witness what's going on.
And they've wanted that for some time. This has been an ongoing struggle, although we haven't seen these kind of protests in several decades. I'm assuming it's because of the international attention being focused on the upcoming Olympics.
Absolutely. In private, Tibetans have been planning for quite some time the actions they're going to take in the run-up to the Olympics and possibly during the Olympics. I think with 2009 being the 50th anniversary of the Chinese takeover of Tibet, the Tibetans see this as a last-ditch effort, really their last chance to focus attention on what's happening in their homeland and perhaps the best opportunity they're going to have in the foreseeable future to influence the outcome of the Tibetan situation.
Peter, many of the protesters in your city are desperately trying to get in touch with their family members or friends over the mountainous border with Tibet. Now, I know you've talked to some of these people. What are they hearing from their loved ones?
Right now, it's a frightening silence. The communications between Tibet and the outside world are severely restricted. To give you one example, I was talking with a 27-year-old Buddhist nun the other day. She's been in India for the past 15 years, and her family is in Lhasa, the capital of the Tibetan area. Now, normally, they can communicate with people there by telephone, by email, by cell phone, all the ways we normally communicate, but she's unable to reach her family at all. So she has no way of knowing whether someone in her family may have been arrested or injured. And I talked with a Tibetan journalist friend of mine who says he has all kinds of contacts within Tibet, and one of them had been feeding him information as the uprising went on, and then suddenly he couldn't reach him on his cell phone or any other way. And he says he has no way of knowing whether that person was arrested, perhaps for sharing information with him, or whether he simply went into hiding, or perhaps had his cell phone confiscated, or maybe it just doesn't work anymore. There's no way of knowing.
So I imagine that would be adding a lot to the tension and fear among the Tibetans in the community where you live.
Absolutely. And it's also fueling their call for an international probe into what's happened in Tibet. The Dalai Lama himself said an international coalition of trusted bodies that would include Chinese officials should launch a public investigation into who's been injured, how things got started, and the reaction on the part of the Chinese authorities.
Peter Aronson is in Dharamsala, India. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's a tough question, and it's one that's asked frequently in the aid community. What is the best way to lift Africa out of poverty? Is it foreign aid, or is it trade? Will microlending really make a difference? Journalist Robin Farzad came up with another idea when he reported on a small number of businessmen who are investing in profit-making schemes in Africa. Could greed save Africa? We invited him onto the show to answer that question. Robin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
The title of the story you wrote for Business Week is Can Greed Save Africa? That's a pretty provocative title.
Right. We did really throw down a provocative gauntlet on the cover because it's hard enough to get anybody in the States to read a piece about Africa and the vagaries of development economics there. And the instant you read the story, you realize we're not extolling greed outright as much as a way of getting money to Africa through business thinking.
So let's talk about what we are extolling here. You got engineers, CEOs, and business entrepreneurs from Western countries going to some really desolate places in Africa to start businesses. Where is the money to be made there?
Let's be honest here. Sub-Saharan Africa is really the epicenter of poverty and misery. You talk about AIDS, you talk about all the things that Bono and Bill Clinton and the philanthropists have been telling us here. But to step back for a minute, I'm a business journalist, and I know that very successful investors are often the contrarian people, the ones who don't read all the disclaimery boilerplate about the place and pay attention to the stereotypes. And they actually go in and try to find real opportunities. They try to get maximum bang for their buck. And if they can actually end up improving the lot of people there and end up reversing some of these terrible statistics we see in terms of malaria incidents, the dire poverty that we see there, well, then everybody's the better for it.
Give us examples, if you will, of what kind of businesses are flourishing there.
Look, we have oil at $100 a barrel. We know that the supply is finite. There's a huge biofuel craze happening the world over, and investors are looking for sources of biofuel. So I cross paths with these investors out of London, Iranians who have seen Africa through the lens of diamonds and other businesses and logistics and shipping, and they realize that the it crop of Eastern Africa right now is Jatropha. It's an oil seed that grows in really wretched conditions in malarial bushes where there's only switchgrass and wastelands, and it just grows like it literally grows like a weed. And Africa has a lot of land, especially in a place like Mozambique, where they decided they could buy 200,000 acres of land. I mean, how often is something like that available on the cheap and have such an appreciative workforce, people who haven't worked for 30 years? And these guys realize that not only does the rest of Africa need biodiesel desperately, but if we have any excess production, we can ship it off to the rest of the world. I mean, Mozambique is on the Indian Ocean. We could get this to India. We can get it to China. I mean, this is the type of place where it absolutely logistically makes sense for us to do this.
Jatropha. What do you do with this?
Well, what it has is this fruit. And when you crack the fruit open, there's a massive black seed in it. And once it's pressed, the oil really lends itself to biofuel production. And I saw that in the first person. Literally every country I visited in Africa, I mean, I'm talking 7 or 8 countries, had a really cruddy power grid, and people were inordinately dependent on diesel generators. And people there need biofuel.
And who's making the money off of this?
Well, it's one example of really an incredible nexus of venture capital, because these guys are venture capitalists. They realize that there's a bit of a kind of a guessing in this. I'm putting the money forward. I'm fronting it. But the project may or may not work out, right? The government might experience a coup. They might expropriate this land. But I'm putting the money forward because the cost of entry is so low. One swath of malaria-infested Mozambique bush that had nil employment for the past 30 years. Suddenly, 620 people are employed. They're very eager to get to work. Some of them walk 5 to 10 miles a day. They're earning money. They're voting for the first time in their lives because this company, these venture capitalists, have given them a government pension. And a government pension gets you a government ID card. It was really striking to see in the first person. There's malaria eradication. And, you know, the on-site manager was a South African gentleman who actually fought in Mozambique back when the two countries weren't friendly, said that, look, I'd be the last person on the planet to go down as a philanthropist, but you cannot run a business when your workers are out sick with malaria or drinking dirty water. And that, more than any other quote in my story, resounded because it shows you how business interests really intersect with human interest.
Historically, outside foreign companies have come in and extracted resources from Africa and just left the country with nothing. But these businesses are different, you say. How exactly are they different?
You know, we're talking about financial sponsors, the likes of firms on Wall Street, insurers who want to diversify their investment base, private equity firms.
Are they less greedy than gold miners?
No, they're. I'm going to take a term that I learned at Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs had a term where it extolled its partners to think long-term greedy. And I saw that in this case because...
long-term greedy.
I know it sounds euphemistic.
No, it sounds. I think I hear what you're saying. Long-term greedy means it's in our best interest to take care of the
people. No, not even that. I mean, if you exploit something, it's going to come back and bite you in the tail. The people are going to resent you. The government is going to come back and say, what the heck are you doing to my people? I'm going to tax you to death. I mean, it sows the seeds of its own demise. That's in no one. No investor wants to go through the trouble of opening up the opportunity, investing in it, hiring all the other people, and then, you know, in the fifth year of operation, deciding to go for an abusive motif.
Well, plenty of investors have done exactly that in the past.
When these investors opened up their books to me and explained their plans, what they're looking to get out of these businesses, many of the time horizons were 10 to 15 years. People saying by the 10th year in that Mozambique biofuel farm, you know, we're hoping to buy another 500,000 acres. We'll be shipping it to these countries. I'm not so impressed that the more mercenary elements who are coming into Africa for the past 150 years said, well, we're going to do this for 20 years and then cut and run. It's kind of a whack-a-mole strategy. Just kind of go in, get it, and get out before things get too hot. And don't get me wrong, there's still plenty of that going on in Africa. But never before have you seen really Wall Street and institutional investors go in with a longer-term horizon.
There is so much debate in the Western world about the best way to pull Africa out of desperate poverty. Some experts say we need to pour money and aid into the country. Others say pouring the aid in doesn't make any difference. How do you think, as a journalist watching and investigating this, that these investors fit into the aid debate?
I think investors, and by the way, I think both elements are very necessary. You need kind of jiggers of both, especially when we talk about health and nutrition and infant mortality. There's only so much the private investors can do immediately. But having said that, aid doesn't have its own self-perpetuating mechanism. Aid is dependent on congressional authorization, depends on the type of people we have in the White House, depends on the need. But private investment is the ultimate self-perpetuating mechanism. I mean, the instant other people find out that this fertilizer is selling like hotcakes or this biodiesel or the microloan business, everybody else tries to pile in. The country is suddenly developed. It's going to move on to the next element of investment. And I don't think aid does that.
Robin Farzad, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Robin Farzad is a writer for Business Week magazine. We spoke with him from New York City. And now, our globe at a glance. March 31st marks the beginning of a new initiative from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's called the Grand Challenges Exploration, and it's all about developing bold and unconventional ideas to fight infectious disease. Diseases like malaria, AIDS, and TB, they account for the majority of deaths in the developing world. The poor are the ones most affected by these diseases. What makes them so vulnerable? Overcrowded living conditions and poor nutrition. Add to that limited access to health care and medication, and you turn treatable diseases into terminal illnesses. The Gates Foundation is offering $100,000 to any scientist with a strong proposal for preventing and treating these diseases. And if any of those proposals prove successful, Gates will award the scientist up to $1 million more. Interested scientists need to move quickly. The deadline for applications is May 30th, 2008. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer, and you're listening to the World Vision Report. Ronald Mugisa is a social worker who heads up a small nonprofit organization in Uganda. It helps the growing legion of grandmothers now raising their grandchildren. That's because the parents have died of AIDS. Prue Clark spent a day with Mugisa and sent us this report.
First stop this morning is 72-year-old Victoria Kabahoma. A small, wiry woman, Victoria welcomes us from the front door of her mud hut and invites us to sit on two small benches in her backyard. Let me tell you a story, she says. Victoria speaks of a difficult life. Seven of her 10 children and her husband died of disease. The death of her last surviving son and his wife 4 years ago was the last blow. Mugisa translates for me.
He had a son who died, and the mother of the children also died, the wife and husband. They all died.
From what?
They died of AIDS. They died of this disease which has come. They call it the disease which has come.
Victoria was left to care for five grandchildren.
I had no money. We'd eat what I could grow in the garden. When there was nothing, we didn't eat.
Victoria is typical of the dozens of women Ronald Mugisa has helped. These women are the poorest of the poor. So deprived, they don't even qualify for the microloans that are helping a growing number of poor people too poor to borrow from traditional banks. His organization awards them grants, sometimes as little as $50, and gives them some business training. Then helps them start up small businesses, buying seeds to grow cassava or plantains, say, or dyes to make grass baskets. Mugisa, a tall, enthusiastic 45-year-old, smiles warmly as Victoria leads a brown goat from under a nearby tree. She bought the female goat with part of her grant and mated it with her neighbours.
She's trying to explain. This one produced two young ones.
Victoria sold the two kids. She expects the goat to provide enough offspring to give her a steady income of $30 to $50 a year, enough to feed the children, but not enough to pay the fees that all public high schools charge in Uganda. Mugisa's a popular man here, and a dozen children jump on the back of his metallic blue pickup truck for the ride to his next grant recipient. We get a serenade along the way. Mugisa started his organisation 4 years ago with funding from overseas groups. He was moved to act after watching the number of AIDS orphans here explode. This region was once known for its spectacular game parks. It now plays backdrop to a silent bloodbath. Nearly all the people I meet here are grandparents or grandchildren. AIDS has claimed much of the generation in between. If grandparents can't cope, the children face a bleak future. Most often, says Mugisa, as prostitutes and thieves on Uganda's streets.
They become victims of AIDS again, because when a girl becomes a prostitute, she will end up getting the disease.
Helping grandmothers might seem an obvious solution to the problem of AIDS orphans, but this is a culture in which men hold the purse strings. As we head to his next visit, Mugisa says a man's family often takes his land and possessions when he dies, As a result, many of Mugisa's grandmothers have been left with nothing. Mugisa knows the cost of AIDS firsthand. After three of his siblings died from the disease, his own mother was left to raise eight grandchildren.
It is very sad. And that's why you see every old woman almost crying when they are talking. You produce your son, you know that he will support you when you're in old age, but you end up becoming a parent again.
45-year-old Alice Mazotte watches as her youngest grandchildren bathe in a bucket in the backyard. Chickens peck on the ground near two goats tied up in a pen. A few other children stand around and watch shyly.
How many of these are her grandchildren? I've forgotten how many.
Six.
The oldest is nine. AIDS claimed two of Alice's children, and a third is dying. With a little encouragement, the grandchildren show what they're learning in school. Alice used her grant to buy a goat and a bag of cassava that she makes into porridge and sells. She can now cover school expenses. The children's education has been her number one priority.
If they go to school and become doctors, nurses, teachers, I will be happy.
Bye-bye.
Mugisa heads home at the end of the day with a glow.
Women are so strong than even men. When women are empowered and if they can go into business, real business, they can better support their children than us.
Mugisa says there are many more grandmothers he'd like to help, but his work depends on grants from Europe and America, and so far they don't come nearly big enough to help everyone. For the World Vision Report, I'm Prue Clark in southwestern Uganda.
Cambodia once had a thriving silk cottage industry. It produced some of the most exquisite hand-dyed and woven textiles in Asia. The industry was wiped out in the late 70s by the Khmer Rouge regime and a long civil war. Now, almost 30 years later, one man is helping revive the craft. Megan Williams has this reporter's notebook about her visit to his silk workshop on the outskirts of Siem Reap.
In a large, open room, dozens of women sit on mats in front of looms. Their fingers dart, pulling threads to create rich patterns of reds, ochre, and indigo. Nearby, others sit sewing with their babies at their sides. Teenage girls squat in circles around large vats of dye. From time to time, they stir them with long wooden sticks, chatting and laughing. No one looks stressed. The scene has the feel of a knitting bee, but what's going on is a crucial recovering of the past. These women are some of Cambodia's top artisans. Thread by thread, they're saving the country's nearly lost art of silk weaving. The silk cloths they make are stunningly beautiful, flowing depictions of bucolic themes, animals, dancers, landscapes, and deep resonating colors. All are works of art. A few are even on display at museums like the Smithsonian Institute. The person helping revive Cambodia's silk tradition is a 52-year-old Japanese man named Kikuo Morimoto. He's small and deeply tanned, with short-cropped salt and pepper hair and an infectious laugh. His teeth are gold-capped and tobacco-stained, the result of cigarettes he smokes one after another. He manages to pull off looking both rugged and refined. Morimoto tells me he's a silk fanatic. In the 90s, after the Khmer Rouge had murdered several million people and decimated traditional Cambodian life, Morimoto realized the secrets of silk dyeing and weaving had nearly perished as well. So he became a kind of Indiana Jones of silk. He traveled the Cambodian countryside, risking his life to landmines and Khmer Rouge soldiers, seeking out anyone who still knew the old methods. Painstakingly, he put the pieces together. From one survivor, he'd glean a special technique to fix the famous Cambodian red made from lac insects. From From another, he learned how to get the most intense blue. Some of the secrets he uncovered had their ironies. In the back courtyard of the workshop, Morimoto points to a huge cast iron pot sitting in the sun.
It's like a secret. They put the water and the lime. There's some sugar.
Sugar?
Yes.
It is like cooking.
Yes.
In the pot, Silk is soaking in a murky concoction. Morimoto flashes me one of his crazy grins and pulls out a tangle of rusted metal. It's a rifle, he tells me, from Cambodia's civil war. The high-quality metal in guns is one of the best ways to fix a die. 300 people now work and even live at the Siem Reap workshop. Almost all are women, grandmothers, mothers, and daughters. When I stop to chat with them, they all tell me the same thing, how they appreciate that earnings from sales are divided fairly among workers. But especially, they say, it's the link with the past they treasure, the chance to keep one of the few surviving Cambodian traditions going. For Morimoto, it's something else as well. Morimoto tells me that without heart as your starting point, you can't produce beautiful things. I say to myself, yeah, that's true. But as I do, I'm not thinking of the silk designs. I'm hearing the quiet hum of the looms and the gentle laughter around me.
Megan Williams is a writer and correspondent based in Rome. There's a slideshow of the silk workshop on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And that brings us to the end of our show this week. Remember, you can hear us anytime on that website. The address again, worldvisionreport.org. You can also sign up there for a podcast if you prefer to take us with you. Our radio team includes Mark Bandy, Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, and I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.